The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Liz Elliott from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine from May 2019, Volume 20, Number 5. This is the first of 5 installments of the May issue. On the cover this month, Oprah is pictured against a white background. She's wearing a form-fitting magenta self-belted sweater dress, and it's paired with bright orange pointed toe heels. Her arms are wide open, and she's got a joyful expression. Her wavy hair is blowing in the breeze, and up in the top left-hand corner of the cover, there's a bright orange square that coordinates with her shoes. And against it, she's holding a white O, the Oprah logo, which is a perfect circle with a long oval opening in the center. Oprah's quote on the cover this month is, "It's possible to have many mothers. There's the one who gave birth to you, and then there are all the women who raised you up." Now let's take a look at the behind-the-scenes section of this month's issue. And it's a really fun 2-page spread of Oprah's girls' trip, which was a big cruise she took with over 2,000 people on the latest Holland America cruise ship. And the opening reads, "What happened when we loaded Holland America Line's latest ship, the new Stadendum, with masses of fun-loving O fans? An unforgettable friendship-fueled adventure." For Girls' Getaway in January, Oprah took the helm, figuratively speaking, leading more than 2,000 women and 58 brave men on a 3-day excursion to the Bahamas, full of experiences to nourish mind, body, and soul. "I've never seen anything like this," said Oprah, the ship's godmother, during its christening ceremony. "This cruise was our best one yet, and one of the best things I've ever done." The first picture in the spread has Oprah in a room full of people. She's wearing these black pajamas with the Oprah logo and white piping along the edge. And it looks like all the ladies in the room are also wearing pajamas. Looks like a big pajama party on the cruise ship. And the caption reads, "Oprah passes out shots of tequila at an onboard pajama dance party." On the next page, we see a picture of Gail King and a friend actually on horseback on the beach with this beautiful blue water behind them. You can see the cruise ship off in the distance. And in the next picture, Gail and the friend are still on horseback, but they're out into the water. And that caption reads, "Gail giddy-ups in the sand and surf on Half Moon Cay Island in the Bahamas." Below that, there are several pictures of people working out and just chatting and walking around on the ship. All kinds of fitness classes going on this cruise. On the bottom right, there's a picture of Gail King and Oprah, and it looks very much like her talk show set. And the caption reads, "Gail and Oprah take the stage to give pointers on how to live your best life." And in the top right, there's a picture of Oprah with a more mature lady and a very young girl. And that caption reads, "The girls' getaway was for guests of all ages, the youngest being 6 and the eldest 93. The next picture has 4 friends in a group shot, 2 ladies and 2 gentlemen, and they're all wearing blue jeans and they have custom-made shirts on, and the shirts just picture Oprah's face repeated over and over again so that the entire surface of the shirt is covered in Oprah's face. And the caption reads, "4 friends and 1 fabulous Oprah tribute." Next to that is a picture of a fitness instructor in a squat position. She's dressed in all black. She's got a black cap on. She's holding a microphone up to her mouth. Looks like she's giving everyone fitness instructions. And that caption reads, "Fitness evangelist Angela Davis gets the crowd moving with a workout that boosted heart rates and spirits." Below that, there's another instructor on the beach. Hands in the air in front of the beautiful blue water and the cruise ship in the background. And that caption reads, Instructor Tracy Stanley gets every Wednesday started right with a beach meditation session. Also on that page is a picture of a gentleman dressed in all white with a navy blazer, and he's holding out a scarf. Looks like he's trying to fold it somehow. And that caption reads, Creative Director Adam Glassman shares scarf tying skills during a fashion show in partnership with Talbots. And next to that, there are several people in matching white t-shirts holding up a big banner. It says $6 million celebration, and that caption reads, At the On Deck for Our Cause 5K Walk, publisher Jane Jameson holds a check representing the $6 million raised for cancer research by the Holland America Line. Now let's move to the Here We Go section and read Oprah's opening comments. Before we begin her opening comments, I would like to describe that Oprah is standing again, like on the cover, against the beautiful, bright, white background. And she's sitting on a big, round O, the Oprah logo again, with the long oval opening. White, quite like the background. So her beautiful magenta sweater dress just pops against that white background. Again, paired with the orange pointy-toed heels. And this time, with her hair swept back up off her first shoulder, you can see that her sweater dress is an off-the-shoulder design, and it really shows off these beautiful hanging earrings with a magenta stone. And it's a very springy color combination. It's very bright and light, and Oprah's looking kind of up and out, again with a smile on her face. And her opening comments read, Of the many relationships we have in life, few make as profound an impact as the one we share with our mother. That connection, whether strong or strained, influences who we become in countless ways. It teaches us how to be, or how not to be, adults, partners, and parents to our own children. Motherhood comes up numerous times in my new book, The Path Made Clear, Discovering Your Life's Direction and Purpose. It's a collection of some of the wisdom I've been privileged to receive in conversations with artists, visionaries, and trailblazers of all kinds. People as diverse as Mindy Kaling, Joe Biden, Justin Timberlake, and Stephen Colbert all told me about the abiding influence their mothers had on them. The richly varied nature of that influence is exactly what we set out to capture in this month's issue of O. In a series of moving, sometimes funny, sometimes bittersweet essays in which mothers and daughters explore the heart of this primal bond. How do you come back from an event that upends your life? That's the harrowing question one man asked himself after a debilitating stroke, which turned out to be the beginning of a long, illuminating journey. Melinda Gates has been on quite a journey herself, stepping up her advocacy work around the world and finding new ways in which women can help other women. I spoke with her about her mission, and it was a conversation that left me inspired. I hope what you read in this issue about mothers, daughters, starting over and more has the same effect on you. Enjoy. In the top right-hand corner of the Here We Go section, there's a little caption that reads, A great gift for graduates, Oprah's new book, The Path Made Clear, Discovering Your Life's Direction and Purpose, is available in a print edition and as an audiobook. A podcast version of the accompanying Super Soul Sunday special can be downloaded on iTunes. Now, as we do every month, let's head over to the reading room and check out 10 titles to pick up now. The first is 50 Things That Aren't My Fault by Kathy Geiswhite. Nearly a decade ago, after 34 years, the creator of the iconic Kathy comic strip retired to spend more time with her teenage daughter and 90-something parents. But, as these ebullient essays reveal, she hasn't lost her sense of humor. whether writing about delusional clothes or how long to wait before responding to a date's text. Number 2 is entitled All That You Leave Behind by Aaron Lee Carr. New York Times columnist David Carr breathed insight and verve into media criticism while wrestling with personal demons before dying in his newsroom 4 years ago. In a piercing memoir, Carr's daughter, a recovering alcoholic and drug abuser like her dad, combs through his writings, including texts and emails they exchanged, to map a way through her grief. Number 3 is entitled Lights All Night Long by Lydia Fitzpatrick. After his beloved older brother confesses to a series of murders in Russia, 15-year-old Ilya emigrates to the Louisiana Bayou and attempts to unravel the mystery of what really happened in the slyly comic Knife in the Heart debut novel. Number 4, Feast Your Eyes by Myla Goldberg. The B-season author reimagines the novel as a museum show catalog, tracing the turbulent career of a Sally Mann-style photographer grappling with doom and transcendence. A daringly inventive parable of female creativity and motherhood. Number 5. The Tradition by Jericho Brown. The poet's scorched earth verse adroitly reckons with a black man's place in the perceived natural order. When you've been worked on for so long, you never know you're done. Paint dries. Midnight is many colors. Black and blue are only 2. Number 6, The Parisian by Isabella Hammond. A Francophile from Ottoman Palestine witnesses the unfolding of World War I and his homeland's rising nationalism in this lush historical epic with echoes of Stendhal. Number 7, What My Mother and I Don't Talk About, edited by Michelle Philgate. By turns joyously heartwarming and plaintively forlorn, a dynamic cast of essayists, Keith Lehman and Leslie Jameson among them, riff on the women who are our first homes and the lies that make fools of people we love. Number 8, A Wonderful Stroke of Luck by Ann Beatty. A charismatic yet diabolical teacher from a young man's private school past surfaces to wreak havoc in this engaging return to the novel by a short story master. Number 9, Machines Like Me by Ian McEwan. To truly love, do we need a beating heart? In a feat of literary sorcery, McEwan conjures an alt-universe 1980s Britain as a restless couple forms a triangle with Adam, a man-bot short-circuited by desire. Number 10, Trust Exercise by Susan Choi. Prep meets Fates and Furies in Choi's rhapsodic, genre-busting fifth novel about students at an elite arts academy whose teenage troubles and deceits reverberate cataclysmically years later. And now we head to this month's special section, and as they do every month in O Magazine, the special section first page is a creative take on the letter O logo, and it's this month a bicep tattoo. You see someone's, just their upper arm, hanging out of a white tank top, and the O is a big pink O tattooed on their upper arm. There's a purple banner draped across the O that spells out MOM with a little blue bird at the top right of it. And on the top left of the O and the bottom right of the O, there's a little garland of flowers. And the caption reads, "Nobody leaves a more permanent mark on us than our mother." And as these moving stories prove, no two mom-daughter dynamics are exactly alike. Oprah talks with Melinda Gates about her efforts to give women around the world a brighter future. And if your life were turned upside down, how would you rebuild? One man was forced to answer that very question. And that is our introduction to the O special section this month. And our first story is entitled To Her with Love. What makes the relationship between mother and daughter so fraught, so ferociously loving, so freighted with meaning, whether you speak daily or she's been dead 20 years? Five women weigh in on the wonders of this singular bond. And it includes illustrations before each of these five stories by Julia Breckenried, and they're beautiful, almost watercolor looking illustrations. And the first story is entitled The Long and Binding Road. And this illustration pictures a woman with a short reddish strawberry blonde bob, and she seems to be painting with a younger dark-skinned girl, and the young girl's hair is back in braids with a curly ponytail, and the background is just this myriad of bright colors just washed everywhere as if they were done by the mother and daughter with their paintbrush. And again, our first essay is entitled The Long and Binding Road. It was hard for Jacqueline Mitchard's adopted daughter to accept her new home, and even harder to accept the woman offering it. I remember exactly where I was when I first saw her face. On a cold fall afternoon, I was sitting on my bed with my laptop, revising a novel, when an email arrived. A friend had sent me a photo of four little girls, all Ethiopian orphans. She hoped to adopt two of them. But it was one of the others, the oldest, who drew my eye. She was the most beautiful human being I'd ever seen. She would likely never be adopted, my friend told me. She would likely be forced to support her little sister, the fourth girl in the photo, by working as a prostitute. She would likely contract AIDS and be dead before age 20. Her dad had died of AIDS, and when her birth mother saw no alternative but to surrender her children for adoption, this girl had threatened to drink bleach. She would never leave her mother, she said. She would never go to America. I tried to put the girl out of my mind, dragging the photo to my computer's trash can, then emptying it. But I could not forget her face. One day, on what I convinced myself was a mere whim, I called the adoption agency. Had anyone adopted the other two girls in the photo? No, I was told. The big sister was the problem. She was difficult. I asked, did she have special needs? No, the social worker said. She was just fierce. My husband and I had enough children. Seven, to be exact, some biological, some adopted. They ranged in age from Rob, 23, to Atticus, just 3. We'd also recently had a financial catastrophe, hardly a good time to take on more responsibility. Yet, I felt such a longing for this fierce child. And so, 10 months later, on Christmas Day, Merritt and her little sister Marta came home to me. At first, things seemed fine. Merritt was fascinated by snow. She loved her Christmas presents. I was optimistic. I knew cross-cultural adoptions could be complicated, even seen by some as wrong. But I'd done this before. What could be so different? This. Merritt hated me. In the days after her arrival, she grieved with an intensity I had never before witnessed. She refused to eat anything except bread. All she wanted from me, she let me know, was an education. She told me one night, as we walked to our minivan in a parking lot, that she would never be an American citizen, ever. Honey, I told her, you already are. Merritt turned and kicked the side of the van, denting it. The other kids gasped. I am not your honey, she said. And she was not. At times, I could draw merit to me. When I cooked, I would measure the ingredients, and unobserved, she would put them in the pot. She let me take her out to skate on the frozen lake, where she was absolutely unequipped and absolutely fearless. She laced up her skates and fell 40 times. We went together for swimming lessons, and at the pool, she climbed the ladder to the highest diving board and jumped into the deep end, straight down to the bottom, where she stayed until I hauled her up. She clung to me until we reached the edge, then pulled herself out, refusing my help, and walked away. When I read Little Women aloud for the other children, she would listen outside the door. I even took her to Orchard House in Concord, Massachusetts, and showed her the room where Louisa May Alcott wrote. I saw tears in her eyes when I told her the classic was based on the author and her own three sisters. But Merritt denied how moved she was. "It's not real," she said. "It's a story." On her first birthday in the United States, when she turned 11, we played a game, a family tradition. Each of us expressed a wish for Merritt. Then she got to voice a wish for herself. "To move to a beautiful, huge city far away from here," she said with a smile. Finally, I realized all I could do was all I could do. Nothing would ever bring us closer. A year passed this way. I think the fight was about my putting butter on her peas. She hates butter. But whatever it was, on a frigid fall evening, Merritt refused to come inside, sitting all night on the trampoline in our backyard, drinking water from the hose, telling the other kids she didn't care whether coyotes ate her. Eventually, I gave up trying to lure her inside. I woke to find Merritt in the darkness next to my bed. I wondered whether she would hit me. Instead, she said, "Okay, I'll take you as my mother." She got into the bed and I held her, and she cried for 3 hours until she fell into a sleep that lasted a night and a day. I have never struggled so mightily for a relationship. Not with a lover, nor a husband, not with anyone. We still rarely go a month without a verbal sparring match. And yet, of all my children, Merritt is the one I know without question would risk her life for me. Not long ago, I heard her describe the house she'd build when she's grown, with 5 bedrooms. One for her and her husband, one for her daughter, one for her son, and one for guests. "That's only 4," someone said. "Well, one is for Mom," she said. "When Mom is an old lady, she will live in my house." For her college essay, she wrote about my struggles to grow a lemon tree indoors. It included the lines, "I am my mother's lemon tree. I thrive where I was not planted." Our next essay is entitled Stronger Together. Chris Crenwell traveled to the foothills of Georgia and the solace of 19 strangers to grapple with the singularly devastating loss. My mother died of cancer when she was 34 and I was 10. As a young person, I struggled to envision living past the age she was when I lost her. Once I did, I had no idea what to do with myself. Part of me still felt 10 years old, waiting for guidance I would never receive. Mother's Day was the loneliest day of the year, a reminder of what was missing. I refused to celebrate it with my kids. For nearly 40 years after her death, I told myself I was fine. And outwardly, I was. I'd managed to become a successful, thriving adult. But the kid in me was still suffering, and she did not know how to make it stop. Grief, unresolved, lurking, popped up at random, inappropriate times. Over the years, I'd feel a little zing in my chest when I saw mothers and daughters shopping or having lunch. When my friends complained about their moms, I couldn't commiserate. In fact, I often grew angry. At least you have a mother to annoy you. I was fascinated by women the age my mother would have been, but hesitant to befriend them. I didn't want to appear too needy to turn them into surrogate moms against their will. Like most people, I cried during Steel Magnolias, but when I couldn't stop bawling at the end of Bad Moms, I knew I had some issues to address. Chief among them was the fear I'd lost my connection to my mother, the person, rather than my mother, the sick person. When I remembered her, I always pictured her ill and feeble. But in life, she had been positive and upbeat, with a loud laugh and a Texas drawl. She called everyone honey. To me, she looked like a combination of Elizabeth Taylor and Mary Tyler Moore, tall, with black hair, sparkly hazel eyes, and a huge fuchsia smile. She was proud of her Grecian nose and double D's. She was chubby and couldn't have cared less. She was her college's homecoming queen. She sat on the PTA. She was fearless, and people liked her. And I wanted to superimpose that version of her over the invalid who had hijacked my memory. So a few years ago, I attended a motherless daughter's weekend retreat at a spa in Georgia's wine country with 19 other women, all of whom had been 20 or younger when their mothers died. I was intrigued, but wary. Growing up, I'd learned to not talk about my mother. Doing so made other people uncomfortable, I've found. Also, I'm not great at sharing with strangers, and while I enjoy yoga, which was on the agenda, I worried I'd have to bear all in group discussions, maybe engage in sappy trust falls. What I found instead was a sisterhood. Sitting in a circle in the yoga studio, which had a 180-degree view of the Blue Ridge Mountains, we told our stories. Each was different, but as I listened, I heard themes from my own life. We all felt the same, stuck, frozen at the age we'd been when our mothers died. We all had a fear of dying young, and once we didn't, a sense that we lacked a path forward. We had difficulty connecting with loved ones, because what if they died too? I wasn't the only one who always hated celebrating her own birthday, who hid in her room when she got her first period, who waffled on marrying her longtime boyfriend, who squirmed when someone called her a woman because she felt like a child. We all dreaded Mother's Day. We were asked to remember anecdotes about our mothers and then use them to introduce our moms to each other. The details of our relationship, of who she had been, came flooding back. I told the group how my mother bought me my first Nancy Drew book at an Albertsons grocery store and how I'd loved mysteries ever since. One woman's mother enrolled her in dance classes and hoped she'd become a Rockette. Another mom sent multiple gifts with her daughter to birthday parties so siblings weren't left out. Since we were of varying ages and circumstances when our mothers died, some relationships were more complex. A few had been teens, and they remembered conflicts they'd had with their mothers, while others were too young to form concrete memories at all. I felt grateful for my kind, sunny mother. I felt even more grateful to be able to remember so much of her. In one exercise, we were asked to hold up our mother's photo and say our name and also hers. I wasn't prepared for this. I hadn't said my mother's name in years. As my turn neared, my heart thudded in my ears. I didn't know whether I could get the words out, but I did. I said, "I'm Chris, daughter of Penny." Speaking of her this way made her a person again. Not a memory, or an illness, or a taboo subject that made others feel awkward. I began to cry, and looking around the room, I saw everyone else was crying too. Before heading home, we discussed goal setting, self-care, staying in touch. We did a cinnamon roll hug, everyone standing in a line, holding hands, and then starting at one end, spiraling into each other. Group hugs are not exactly my thing, but this was nice because these women were now my friends. There's no getting over this kind of loss. But I've been given tools, a community, a path back to the vibrant version of my mother, to whom no grief is attached. Not long after the retreat, I celebrated Mother's Day for the first time. I've celebrated every year since. Accompanying this story is another one of these beautiful pastel pencil, maybe even like watercolor looking illustrations. And it's a very diverse group of women at the center of the bottom of the photograph, all different skin tones and hair colors and outfits. And they're standing around, and one is inside what looks like a hot air balloon basket with ropes hanging, and there's no balloon at the top, and they're all looking up at the sky. And in the sky, across the top of the photograph, are more hot air balloons, and there's a little, almost indistinguishable figure inside every single hot air balloon. And the top of the hot air balloon is not a balloon, but a round face of a different woman on each balloon. I presume those represent mothers, and it's just a really beautiful photograph. And every woman at the bottom of the photograph that's looking up at the sky has a little smile on her face, and it's a real sense of community among the women in the bottom of the picture of the illustration. And it's very lovely, and the sky is pink, a very soft pink color, very, very feminine picture. Very lovely. Our next essay is entitled Pump Up the Volume. And the illustration accompanying this picture is of a very tall young girl. She's got short, dark, bobbed hair, goes to about her chin. And she's got a little girl's dress on that comes to her knees, yellow with little flowers on it, and little yellow knee socks, and little gold Mary Janes. And she's got a very defiant pose. Her feet are shoulder width apart, and her hands are on her hips, and she's looking up at the sky with a smile. And down at the bottom of her right foot is a very tiny woman with long hair. This woman in this illustration, the tiny woman, looks to be drawn more as an adult, and she's got a bicycle pump, and she's pumping it up, and the hose of the bicycle pump is attached to the foot of the very tall girl. And again, the essay is entitled Pump Up the Volume. Molly Guy teaches her daughter the art and the necessity of sounding off. Recently, I chaperoned a field trip with my daughter's first grade class. On the school bus, the girl sitting beside my child began berating her. She called her a copycat, alleging that my daughter had sneaked a peek at her worksheet. In response, my daughter looked out the window and cried, "Hard. You should know a few things. Number one, she is not a crier. Number two, the girl just sat there, smug as a snake, never said sorry. Number three, I did not intervene. I thought if I did, I would make my kid look like a wimp. I know why she's crying. My daughter prides herself on doing the right thing. Being accused of breaking a rule freaks her out to the bone. So her body reacted, not her brain. It was too much for her mind to bear. At dinner that night, I said, I know it sucks to be called a copycat, but if someone yells at you for something you didn't do, try to get brave. Breathe in slowly. Make your chest big like a lion's. Use your bold voice. Tell the girl, that's not true. I don't like it when you talk to me like that. She climbed up into my lap. She was listening. What happened on the bus was a small thing, but small things can become big things. Growing up, when I went to Supercuts and the hairdresser put the dryer on high, burning my scalp, I never said, please turn that off. I was worried that I'd hurt her feelings. In eighth grade, I got my period all over my jean shorts while my dad drove me to tennis camp. Instead of asking him to pull over so I could change, which required saying something uncomfortable, I showed up at orientation looking like I'd partaken in a massacre. In college, I had one-night stands in which the sex was bad, rough, painfully so, as writhing frat boys left marks on my body with their hands. I pretended I was having fun. I was a girl who kept quiet at all cost. It takes a long time to unlearn that. I don't want my daughter to go through life with sealed lips when something hurts. I don't want her to turn inward when her integrity is on the line. The next time someone tells my daughter, you're doing it wrong, I hope she looks that person in the eye and says, I'm doing it the way I want to do it. The next time someone hurts her feelings, I hope she says, you hurt my feelings, and walks away. I hope she says it loudly. I hope she says what she needs to. I hope she says what I didn't. The next essay is entitled, The Double-Edged Mother. If I ever wondered what my mom wanted for Mother's Day, all I had to do was visit the fridge and look at the list, written in her exquisite cursive she'd made for us kids. The first item, l'air du temps, or for those of us who couldn't yet read, a glossy photo of the perfume cut from a magazine. She was all want, my mother, particularly when it came to attention. For that, her hunger was insatiable. There were four of us kids, plus my dad. If one didn't give her what she desired, she'd move on to the next. If it was your turn, she'd whisper in your ear while everyone was sleeping, come on, let's go get some coffee. And you'd know she meant eggs and Taylor ham at the diner. And that there you'd hear some small, revelatory detail about her life that she'd entrust to you and only you. In that moment, nothing else mattered. Not the time she slammed you into the wall for eating leftover Chinese food in their air-conditioned bedroom, the house's only air-conditioned room, because you knew she was on a diet and the smell made her hungry. Not the time she forgot about pickup and left you at school for hours. Not the time she swore you weren't invited to that birthday party because, you now suspect, she just didn't feel like taking you. None of it mattered. She had chosen you, and you were magnificent. For years, I tried to address these injuries. The college financial aid forms she never filled out, the high tea bridal shower she insisted on planning, during which she consoled me because she hadn't invited any of my friends. But that was impossible. Either she didn't remember these events or wouldn't allow herself to. It was like arguing with an amnesiac. The solution, it turned out, was death. At 59, my mother suffered a massive heart attack and died several weeks later. I left the hospital one night and she still existed. I fell asleep, woke to a telephone call in my darkened bedroom, and learned she no longer did. On a rainy September day, we gathered to bury the mom who had hurt me repeatedly, deeply, forgetfully. That was when my own amnesia began to lift. I remembered good things, not just the bad. I remembered the mom who taught me to add a pat of butter to tomato sauce, who befriended every waiter who served her, who made a pros and cons list with me when I was deciding which job to take after college, who invited lonely strangers to our Thanksgiving dinners. This was the mom who put a map on her wall when I drove across the country and used colored thumbtacks to track my route, accepting my collect calls the whole way. The mom who could make me believe I was wondrous because she was looking at me, smiling, offering me an adventure. This is the mom I chose to save. In one memory, it's dark out. I have homework. I know the gas is expensive. Let's go for a drive, she says. Her antidote to any pain, this time mine. She backs out of the driveway and onto the main road, throws the car into drive, cranks up Space Oddity. Soon, instead of houses, there are trees, and then only blackness. My mom and I are hurtling through space, singing. I loved her then with wild abandon, with no hurting or wanting between us. Now, every time I belt out Magic Man like she did, or befriend my waiters, I'm choosing the best version of my mom. I conjure the best grandmother for my children. I make her magnificent. Before we move into our final essay on motherhood, we have one more illustration. Still the same soft watercolor, pastel, almost cartoonish appearance to the photo. And it is of two women on a boardwalk carnival setting. You see the boardwalk beneath their feet with the railings in the background and balloons, and the sky is a very soft blue with clouds. And they are standing behind a board with just bodies painted on it. And the bodies depict a lady dressed to go out for the evening in a very short, tight red dress. And on the right, it's another lady's body dressed for business very conservatively in a navy suit. But the heads that are peeking out above the painted board are of two women above the body painted to go out for the night. Is the head of a more mature lady with a very stylish gray bob, and she has a very satisfied, happy-looking smile on her face. And above the more conservatively dressed body appears to be the head of a younger lady who doesn't look so pleased, and she's got a low, dark ponytail, very conservative, very serious hair. And now we move to our final essay that accompanies this illustration, and it's entitled The Great Escape. I will never have sex again. This is what my mother told me after my father left her. We never had an orthodox relationship. She was not even technically my mother. She did not originate the role. The woman who did disappeared when I was 8, but she took it on and made it hers. I had not always been an easy charge, but we each had a lot of love to give and spoil each other with our excess. We were not a family for boundaries. When I was a child, she told me sex was something beautiful and full of love between adults. She wanted me to know the names for all my parts and how to keep them ventilated. My vagina, she explained, was a glory organ, deferred, autonomous, self-cleaning, like an oven. I grew to womanhood with a hearty view of sex, albeit more in theory than in practice. My mother did have sex again. She had a whole heroic renaissance. At 50, divorced and terrified, she moved to Florida with no job, no plan, no resume, no health insurance. She shed 40 pounds of unhappy marriage weight and set about frolicking in the pleasure gardens of the Treasure Coast. She got a minimum wage gig at a country club spa and fitness center and made friends with everyone, from CEO to groundskeeper. She went blonde, exfoliated, face-masked, painted her nails screaming coral pink. She flounced about in floral prints, bedazzled sandals, her hair frizzing in the humid nights. And she had love affairs with bartenders and married men, with a trumpet player, an architect, a film director, and a hockey coach. She had wild sex, she told me, in her bed and theirs, in other people's swimming pools, in hammocks, under big fat starry skies, on Skype. She ransacked Victoria's Secret clearance tables and bought home jungle print lingerie by the pound. She got Botox with a Groupon. She started getting regular Brazilians. I was thrilled for her, minus the waxing, which I viewed as a betrayal of our code. I enjoyed her exploits, mostly secondhand, living, as I was, a cloistered life in New York City. After my share of loveless sex and sexless love, I'd finally found the man I would marry and settled into monogamy. I was in grad school, reading, writing, and drinking pots of tea. My mother and I would chat as she was running out for drinks, a country concert, cougar night. I'd be at home in PJs listening to a violin concerto, about to go to bed. I wore shades of gray to all her neon pink. She joked that I was living out her 50s while she lived out my 20s. She wasn't wrong. She went to piano bars, wrote amateur erotica, drank champagne, swam naked off her apartment complex dock, and generally cavorted like a woman half her age. Right up until she died. And a car crash at age 58 in the passenger seat of her boyfriend's SUV. Now that she's gone, I try to sparkle more, behave a little less. I remember how she used to refer to me, her then 20-something daughter, as the fun police, far too serious and staid. "Live a little," she would taunt. And I would knock back a tequila shot and dive after her into the sea. There were times I felt I had to be the mother, to drive her home after too many pineapple flirtinis at the Breakers Bar, help her stumble into bed and try to feed her water, ibuprofen, a banana, before she fell asleep. But I cherish those times. I was thrilled to see her come alive. And now, at 35, I have so few regrets about my 20s. I gave them to my mother, and she lived them well. We're at the end of our essays, but now, before we wrap up our Hour of Oprah, I want to visit the question, which is at the beginning of every month of O Magazine. And this month's question for May is, what is the most important thing you've learned from your mother? Latoya Lawrence from Suffolk, Virginia says, the importance of family, My sister and I were 3 years apart, and when we were younger, I would always have to take her everywhere I went. I hated it. But as an adult, I can't see myself doing things without her. She's my best friend. Thanks, Mom. Lucy Wellmaker from Greensboro, North Carolina, says it is never too late. My mom read her first book at age 81, one I'd written. Lynette Elliott of Dallas says, how to sew. After stitching my way into adulthood, I'm paying it forward by teaching others, children and adults, an invaluable and soul-feeding creative skill. It's such a joy. Pam Bukelic of Bismarck, North Dakota, says, if you learned one thing from an experience, it was worth it. It is a maxim I reflect on often. Amanda Mullen of Chicago says, never give up. When my mother was diagnosed with lung cancer at 49, she went through countless treatments, always staying hopeful. I watched her fight till her very last breath. Ann O'Neill from South Burlington, Vermont, says, when I was a little girl, my mother taught me not to put anything in a letter I wouldn't want to see on the front page of the New York Times. In this age of oversharing on social media and in emails and texts, this is truly sound advice. If you don't write it down, it can't come back to haunt you. Drew Ali Senesak of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, says her mother taught her, you have nothing to lose by being kind. And we've got time for one more article from the Feeling Good section. Actually, this was from December 2018, but it's really interesting. It's about the Instant Pot versus the slow cooker, and it's a comparison article. And it covers which effort-saving appliances could help you eat better. If you're resolving to make more nutritious meals at home in 2019, good news. These two super convenient devices can speed and simplify cooking. We asked experts to highlight their best features so you can figure out which is right for you. Now here's a list of pros and cons, and the pros for the electric pressure cooker say this appliance, Instant Pot is the best known brand, uses high temperature to steam and cook food quickly. Some models can also act like a rice cooker, yogurt cooker, cake maker, desserts can be part of a healthy eating plan too, egg cooker, saute pan, steamer, warmer, sterilizer, and slow cooker. The pros for the one-function slow cooker say here an electric heating element slowly warms a stoneware pot to cook your food. It's user-friendly, virtually foolproof, set-it-and-forget-it device. You can simply throw in your ingredients, flip a switch, and walk away and stay away for hours. Now, here are the cons to both pieces. The electric pressure cooker con is mastering the cooking functions takes practice. For example, slow cooker recipes often require tweaks to temperature and liquid level and still may not come out as expected. No method is truly instant. Even in pressure cooker mode, the device may need 20 minutes or so to build up pressure and then another 10 to release it. And the cons for the slow cooker are that it is slower than slow and it cannot rescue you from your 5 p.m. what's for dinner dilemma. And consistent gentle heat over such a long period of time can leave food bland and mushy or rubbery. Some food gets that way. Now, here is a comparison chart to let you know what it's best for. The electric pressure cooker is best for easy-to-peel hard-boiled eggs, big batches of hearty whole grains in less time than it takes to simmer them on the stove, speedy dried beans, they're not as salty as canned, but usually need to be soaked for 12 hours before cooking unless you have a pressure cooker. Homemade yogurt is cheaper and less sugary than store-bought. Now, the slow cooker is best for braised meat as well as any hearty vegetable that can stand up to the heat. Potatoes, carrots, eggplants, fennel, caramelized cherry tomatoes to top toast or grain bowls, protein-rich bean and lentil dishes like dal grain dishes such as farro risotto that usually require a little more monitoring. And here are some tips for both the electric pressure cooker and for the slow cooker. Now, with a pressure cooker, don't wing it. Read the manual, follow the instructions, and do the recommended water test to get a feel for your product. Maybe even watch a few YouTube videos. Then use the suggested timetables instead of guesstimating cooking durations, and heed the warnings. The steam release during pressure cooking is really hot. And with the slow cooker, go light on the liquid, especially with vegetables, which tend to have a higher water content. Go heavy, however, on seasonings and spices. Because thin pieces of meat are easy to overcook, make sure you opt for thicker, fattier cuts of pork or beef, as well as chicken thighs over chicken breasts. And to ensure even cooking temps, your pot should be 2/3 to 3/4 full. The bottom line is, if you find time to prep in the morning, the slow cooker can have a meal ready for you when you get home. If you have 45 minutes to an hour in the evening and more ambitious or gourmet plans, pressure cooking is the way to go. Dinner is done. And the experts for this article are Coco Morante, who is the author of the Essential Instant Pot Cookbook, Laurel Randolph, author of the Instant Pot Electric Pressure Cooker Cookbook, Hope Comerford, author of Fix It and Forget It, Healthy Slow Cooker Cookbook, and Sarah DiGregorio, author of Adventures in Slow Cooking. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Liz Elliott, reading for Susan Dellinger, who is your regular host of the Oprah Magazine for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.